Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how a group of RFK Jr. voters feels about their candidate's endorsement of former President Donald Trump, and the story of a farm girl who became a well-known fashion designer. But first, it is time for the Friday Newscap and some voices from the news this week.
Let me be clear. The indictments in this case were not politically motivated. They were the result of a thorough, lengthy, and professional investigation carried out by experienced and dedicated law enforcement officers and prosecutors.
I think Arizona's anti-SLAPP statute's application to criminal prosecutions is a novel development in the law in this country, and I think Judge Cohen properly understands the significance of that.
Almost every poll is somewhere between Harris plus 5 and Trump plus 5. That suggests an almost tied race. We give a small edge to Trump in this poll, but with more than 2 months to go, either candidate could win the state.
I need the independents to come and join us. And I think RFK Jr.'s endorsement went a long way to helping us close that gap.
Chief, could you have somebody come down here and escort Ms. Massey?
Really, is that necessary?
Chamber? Yes,
I think it is. In front of my 10-year-old daughter, you're going to escort
That's
me
fine.
Out for expressing my
she
First
can
Amendment
go with
rights.
You.
And joining me to talk about new polls on the presidential and Senate races in Arizona, the end of the lawsuit over Governor Hobbs state agency directors and more are Daniel Scarpinato, former chief of staff to Governor Ducey, now with the firm Winged Victory. Daniel, good morning.
Good to see you.
And former congressional staffer Roy Herrera. Roy, good morning to you as well.
Good morning. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to both of you. So we don't love to spend a lot of time on polls, and obviously tons of numbers on the radio is not great, but there are a number of new polls that came out this week about both the presidential race, mostly that one about the Senate race. I want to start just sort of the overall numbers and the trends you guys are seeing in the presidential race. There was a poll from OH that found former President Trump leading Vice President Harris in Arizona by 3 points. Emerson College had a similar margin with a former President Trump leading. Fox News had a poll that found Harris leading by a point in Arizona. Daniel, obviously, you know, these numbers are fungible. It's still a couple months away from Election Day. What does this tell you about what do these snapshots in time tell you about where we are right now?
I think where I see things is people call us a swing state. We are. But in many ways, we're more of a divided state. I think you have about 46% to 48%. On either side that have made up their minds. And that's where these races are really going to start. I always felt like the polling that we saw before President Biden got out of the race was not really realistic. I mean, I think in this environment for a candidate to win Arizona in a race like that by 6 to 8 points is probably not going to happen. So I think that we're back to a point of kind of a more stable, normal race. I do think President Trump has rebounded a bit, and this is going to be a barn burner. What I find more interesting as a consumer of this information than the polling is sitting in on focus groups with swing voters, and you really get a sense of how conflicted they are and how they're making their decisions and how much, in a way that isn't really reflective in the polling, how much economic anxiety is driving a lot of their feelings about all these issues, including immigration and the border. And so I think that the candidates who talk about economic issues, that's really the spot that's going to move a lot of these swing voters.
Roy, what are you seeing here? I mean, obviously, you know, as Daniel said, it's going to be close here. I mean, maybe 10,000 votes, kind of like right. 4 years ago close. But is that kind of what you're seeing in these varying poll numbers?
I think that's right. I mean, there's a range here, but it all points to, I think, to one thing, which is that it's basically a toss-up. It's basically tied right now. And, you know, your mention of 10,000 votes, I mean, that's what Biden won by in 2020. I can totally see a scenario where either Harris or Trump win by 10,000 votes again. And so, you know, I think we're kind of back to where we were. I will say, you know, if you're a Democrat, you're feeling a lot better than you did maybe 6 weeks ago, because the polling, you know, after the debate issue with President Biden was really bad. And of course, that was one of the reasons I think he probably got out of the race. And so now being in the race, you know, essentially in a toss-up scenario, I think is a good position. And I think, you know, it's kind of the original position. You know, I think reflects the nature of the state. And then when I think about some of the issues that Scott brought up, I totally agree. I mean, issues like the economy, like the border are animating a lot of people. I would also say that the abortion issue, I mean, in that Fox News poll, you know, they did a poll of the abortion initiative here in Arizona, and I think the approval was something like 73% or something like that. So while some issues I think will play well for the Democrats, that includes, you know, that issue, there's some issues that will play well for Republicans. We're just going to have this, you know, down to the wire fight.
Well, and I think to both of your points, we saw this week that the firm Ad Impact, which tracks political advertising, found that the Phoenix market is the third most heavily invested in market between now and Election Day, more than $107 million worth of TV ads. With due respect to what you guys both do for a living, maybe not a great idea to turn on your TV between now and then.
I think that's right. And I have questioned how much impact this will really have on the presidential race. I'm not sure that this race is about advertising. I think it's about much more, because there's so much attention on it. People have such strong feelings about Donald Trump, and they're starting to formulate, I think, an opinion about Vice President Harris. So I feel like that, you know, there's obviously a ton of money being put into advertising on that. So much of it to me feels kind of like garbage in, garbage out to the voter, because I think that they're making their decisions based on things that they're seeing in the news or reading. I think social media has a big impact. Whereas maybe a decade ago, I think that would have been really the weight of message. The candidate who was winning the TV war, I think, would be better positioned. I just don't really see it that way anymore.
Is there a place still for, I mean, in a streaming world, in a skip ads world, in a DVR where you can fast forward through ads world, is there still a place for that?
I think so. I mean, I tend to agree with Scott, particularly in the presidential race, because, again, like, everyone's entrenched in their views, I think, on both candidates. And also the money is going to be basically the same. So to answer your question, I think where it really matters is when there is a disparity. You know, one side does have a lot more money than the other. And maybe we're going to talk about the Senate race, but that's a good example of where that actually could matter, because it seems like Ruben Gallego is going to have a lot more money than Carrie Lake. So in that scenario, and then also in scenarios where maybe people don't know the candidates very well, that's where it'll matter. But at the presidential level, I don't think it does, because everybody knows these people.
Well, let's talk about the Senate race then, because there was a poll this week, an OH poll, that found Congressman Gallego leading Carrie Lake by 7 points, 47-40%, which is fairly in line with other polls we've seen Congressman Gallego having, at least the public polls that have been released, the nonpartisan polls that have shown Congressman Gallego with a decent size lead over Carrie Lake. Do you anticipate that race is going to be as close as either Senate races that we've seen over the last several cycles here or the presidential race here?
I do. I think it's going to tighten. Ruben Gallego, I think, has had an edge in part because he has been up on television since March or April. I think you're going to see it tighten after Labor Day. I think the cavalry is coming for Kerry in this race. And I also think, you know, when you look at all the races here, I mean, it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, the Mark Kelly, Blake Masters race. Mark Kelly won by 6 points with $100 million and so many advantages built into that. And that's now considered a blowout in Arizona. So I do think this will be tight. And I think it'll be a barn burner and a coin flip like every other race we've seen at the top of the ticket in Arizona.
I wonder, though, Daniel, if to some extent Carrie Lake has a similar issue as Donald Trump and maybe to an extent Kamala Harris, which is that people already know her. And because she's been on TV for a long time, she ran 2 years ago, and for better or worse, they've already formed an opinion of her. Like, I wonder if for her, there's a lot of movement left, whereas someone like Gallego, who has served in Congress for a long time, but around the state, maybe voters don't know him as much, opinions can go up and down on him.
I think opinions can go up and down on him. I think there's going to be a lot of resources coming in to define him over the next several weeks. And that will be, I think, the a key component to how this race shakes out. Is Kerry's allies on the right able to define Rubin in a way that allows her to really win the voters that are going to vote for Donald Trump? Because if she wins those voters, then she wins. So I think that you're going to see a lot more polarization in this race that you haven't seen through the summer.
Roy, do you see this race tightening as we get closer to Election Day as well?
I mean, yes, in a sense, because everything gets tighter. Now, tightening is different than it being tight, right? And so I think, you know, in that Fox News poll, I think he's up by 11 or something over Kerry Lake. Do I think it's going to end up with a spread of 11? Probably not, right? I mean, because, again, this is Arizona. But I think, you know, the Mark Kelly-Blake Masters race, I think, is pretty instructive because I think this is where it's going to end up, where you're in that 5 to 6 point range. And the reason I think I'm confident of that is because, you know, to Scarb's point, I mean, there is this element of the electorate that you have to win, independence that you have to win statewide. And Kerry Lake has demonstrated no ability to actually win those people over. And if anything, I think she's a worse candidate than she was when she ran for the governor's race. So that would be my concern there. Now, on the money issue, I mean, obviously I defer to Scarp. He knows Republican politics better than I do. But I do wonder if the cavalry is coming at the level that she might need. And the reason I say that is because it's not necessary for national Republicans to take the U.S. Senate with the Arizona Senate seat. They can take it back with a Montana seat or Ohio. And so I wonder if the polling is that bad in another month or in October, where Rubin's up by 11, does the cavalry come in, or do they concentrate on other states that are more winnable?
Well, and Daniel, I think to Roy's point, there's been a lot made of Rubén Gallegos' money advantage over Kerry, like just the campaigns. But I think the question is, and the question has always been, how much outside money would come in? There's always been an assumption that both candidates would basically have what they need to get their messages across in the ways that they want. I'm wondering, though, given that, you know, there's polling in Montana, there's polling in West Virginia that shows those are maybe easier pickup opportunities for Republicans. Does all that outside money come in for Kerry Lake that maybe she was expecting?
I think it will. I think the Senate playing field is relatively small. So I don't think that from a national standpoint you can write off any state. So I think Arizona, this will be a marquee race nationally nonetheless. I actually think Kerry has a way better campaign this time around. I think she's got a great team. And the governor's race was very tight. And so I think she actually has shown an ability to get a race really close. And I just think, you know, all of these races are going to be essentially tied in Arizona moving forward. And it's just going to come down to the wire.
All right. That is Daniel Scarpinato. I'm also joined by Roy Herrera. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. The Friday Newscap continues in just a moment. Good morning. It's the Friday Newscap on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. My guest this week, former congressional staffer Roy Herrera, and Daniel Scarpinato, former chief of staff to Governor Ducey, now with the firm Winged Victory. Guys, there was a 3-day court hearing this week in the so-called fake electors case. The electors are trying to get the case dismissed using, among other arguments, the so-called anti-SLAPP law in the state. And Roy, we also learned this week that as the lawyer in the room, I'll start with you on this. We also learned that the case, assuming it proceeds, will not go to trial for another year plus.
Right. And, you know, that's the sort of earliest state, right? I mean, there could be other delays, but it sounds like it's not going to start until 2026. And it sounds like it's going to, at least the judge is indicating, it's going to take several months. So it's just going to be a massive, massive trial. But on the anti-SLAPP issue, I mean, it's an interesting issue, right? You know, whether this anti-SLAPP law applies in this particular context, leaving aside sort of how you are supposed to, you know, apply that law as a policy, you know, I think I have concerns about the fact that this could result in some of these electors not facing, or fake electors, I should say, not facing criminal prosecution. And the reason why I think it's bad policy is because if you can get away with doing that, which in my view was an attempt to steal an election, and there are no penalties, then what's to prevent it from happening again? And I think that's how I, you know, entering another presidential year, this year. These are the kinds of things that I worry about if that is ultimately how that law is going to be applied.
And this is a law, and I'm going to try to paraphrase it. So again, as the lawyer in the room, correct me if I'm wrong here, it's a law that basically is intended to not punish public officials for saying things that in theory could get them in trouble, but as they would consider part of their First Amendment rights.
Exactly. So the idea is that, you know, your free speech rights sort of cover your First Amendment rights, cover this kind of behavior, this kind of activity.
Daniel, does it matter, for example, assuming again that this case is not thrown out and goes to 2026, does it matter for Republican candidates that we're going to continue to be talking about fake electors for another year and a half?
Well, it doesn't sound enjoyable to me, I mean, it's not helpful to anyone. I think that if you're a Republican candidate, you just got to be sane and you have to be clear about, you know, where you are on this stuff and you know, that the election was tabulated and Joe Biden won. So I feel like I feel as a whole, the Republican Party has moved past this. But yeah, it's not helpful.
And yet there are still candidates who are not able to say that, or not at least not willing to say that publicly.
Well, I think now the question that is being raised more is not about the 2020 election, but about the 2024 election. Mm. And, you know, will you accept the results 100% no matter what? And, you know, we will see what happens here. I think we're not going to know the result of the race in Arizona for some time. If it's as close as we're talking about, it could be a week or more before we know how many of these races land. And so who knows what the future holds?
All right. Let's talk about something that you know a little something about, Daniel, from your time in the governor's office. There was a formal agreement this week that the judge signed off on, ending, for now anyway, the dispute between Governor Hobbs and state Senate Republicans over her trying to sort of go around them and get her right. nominees or appointees for agency directors into their offices. Is there any reason to think that we're not just going to be back where we started come January, assuming that everybody does what they are saying they're going to do? The governor says she's going to send the same list of nominees to the Senate, and the Senate saying we're going to do the same thing we did before with those nominees.
Well, I think that this is divided government. It's what Arizonans chose, which is to have a Democratic governor and a Republican Senate. I think that I frankly think a lot of Republicans should be campaigning for these legislative seats on providing balance and being a check and a balance. Some of her original nominees were both a combination of unqualified, extreme on certain issues, or, you know, kind of completely unprepared for the confirmation process. We didn't exactly have an easy route on this stuff, even though we were the same party. I mean, we had to deal with the legislature. We had to negotiate our nominees. There were several nominees that the Republican Senate did not want to confirm. And if we were in a situation where we thought that was going to happen, we didn't put them through that process. We withdrew the name or didn't move forward. So, you know, I do think that no matter whether the governor and her team think that the confirmation committee was polite or the way they would have wanted it to go, this is the process. You need Senate confirmation. And so I think that they would be wise to pick more mainstream appointees for some of these slots and work with the Senate on trying to get bipartisan approval for them.
Do you think that's possible? Given the personalities involved, and you have someone like Senator Jake Hoffman, who is clearly not a fan of Governor Hobbs, who's leading that committee.
Well, but I think that's an important point, because unlike prior governors and situations where there were director nominees that needed to get confirmed, in the past, those nominees would go through the committee of record, you know, the committee that had the jurisdiction over a particular agency. That is not what happened here. We had this newly created committee. And as you've referenced, you know, people like Jake Hoffman were very hostile to the governor, were part of that committee. And it doesn't seem like that's going to change. We're going to go back to that same committee. So I imagine it's going to be somewhat similar. And I do think, you know, I disagree with Scarp a bit on the characterization that these nominees were unqualified. I just think that ultimately what happened, the process that was set up by the Senate Republicans was designed to hurt the governor politically and not actually, you know, address the agency director appointees themselves.
Do you think the governor made the right call in agreeing to basically going back to this arrangement as opposed to continuing to try to litigate it?
Well, I mean, the important point here is that I think she had to go back, right? Because in that litigation, you know, a Superior Court judge found that the process that she undertook in doing these deputy executive directors was an unlawful process.
She could have appealed that, though.
She could have, but ultimately the Superior Court wanted to have some form of settlement between the two parties, and then that's what they went forth and did. And, you know, we'll see. I mean, I hope that this results, you know, next year in a nomination in a process that is not as politicized. And, you know, that's the hope. Otherwise, you know, again, the governor's going to have to think about what are her options.
Not asking you to get inside another human being's head here, but do you think that there was any amount of the thinking on the part of the governor and her team of a bit of a hedge of, hey, maybe come January, Democrats will control the Senate, or it'll be split and we can you know, there can be part of the negotiation and the power sharing, you know, changes to this process?
Well, maybe, although I guess I would just say, you know, governing isn't easy and you have to deal with other people and you have to talk to other people. And I think if Doug Ducey had said, hey, I'm just going to appoint whoever I want through this weird process and not get Senate approval, heads would have exploded and people would have said he was doing something completely illegal, which it would have been. And in this case, clearly there was a violation of what the Constitution lays out. I think the sooner they can figure out how to work with the legislature, build some relationships down there, the better off they're going to be, because this should be the easy part. I mean, you need a functioning state government. It's a big part of the job of being governor. So find people who you can get that support from. And the Senate did approve a lot of people who were more mainstream subject matter experts rather than kind of these more political type appointees.
Roy, just about 40 seconds left. I want to ask you quickly. The court did not answer the question about decisions that the agency directors, the deputy executive, whatever they're called, directors made. Are you expecting litigation on some of those, given what how the court has said they were put in those positions illegally?
Yes, because it didn't take a position on that. And I think that's still an open legal question. In full disclosure, I'm in litigation right now where that may be potentially a question. But, you know, the other thing to sort of think about in this process is that when this nomination process began, of course, there was, a different leadership on the ninth floor for the governor. And so I have much more confidence, I think, in the way, you know, that office is led now going forward, that this process is going to be handled better. But ultimately, it does take two to tango. It takes, you know, a Senate Republican leadership to actually want to objectively, you know, review these nominees and consider them, again, as opposed to politicizing the issue in order to just damage Katie Hobbs.
All right, I'll have to leave it there. Roy Herrera, Daniel Scarpinato, thanks you both for coming in. Have a good holiday weekend.
You too. Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, the story of how a farm girl became a costume designer for some of the biggest stars of her time. But first, there was an alarming headline this week in the Navajo Times. 192 Navajo Nation candidates disqualified from ballot. That's right. Nearly 200 candidates have been kicked off the ballot on the nation's largest reservation, including chapter presidents, school board members, and grazing officials, at least for now. You can trace it back to a new law enacted by the Navajo Nation Council that strengthens campaign finance reporting rules on the reservation. All candidates were required to submit their campaign expense reports by August 9th, but a whole lot of them didn't, and now we're seeing the results. Candidates do have a chance to file grievances about the process and potentially be allowed to stay on the ballot, but no word on where that stands yet. Donovan Quintero has been covering the story for the Navajo Times. My co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with him yesterday about where it all stands and what it could mean.
Well, according to the Navajo Board of Election Supervisor Chairperson Melvin Harrison, previous years, the election office have attempted to really encourage, enforce the law, tell the candidates that they need to turn in their expense reports.
Mm-hmm.
And according to Harrison, they had a tough time. It wasn't really enforceable. And the cases that they sent to the prosecutor's office were dropped only because they weren't enforceable. So the law was introduced and sponsored by a gentleman by the name of Danny Simpson. He is a council, Navajo Nation Council delegate. And that was eventually passed by the council, and it was signed by Navajo Nation President Boone Igren on February 2nd.
Okay, so there are these new laws that really put some very strict, it sounds like, repercussions for candidates who do not file their campaign finance reports on time. What are the sort of downsides for candidates who don't do this?
Well, according to some of the candidates I've spoken to, they say that they weren't properly informed. They didn't get proper notification that when they did sign the paperwork, when they were getting the paperwork processed, they basically said that the election officials didn't say, hey, by the way, there's a new law that we are going to be enforcing, and it's going to be really strict. And then, of course, it sounds like there's also some confusion, whether, you know, some candidates were confused about what they meant by 10 days or 10 working days. So that was another one that they had issues with. The way the administration, election administration handled it may have been a little extreme, according to some of the candidates, because, you know, why disqualify everyone?
Right. I mean, 192 candidates disqualified is a whole lot of people. What kind of impact could that have on the election itself?
That's a great question. That's one question I'm still sifting through right now. But from what I've been gathering, a chapter president official basically has 20 different responsibilities, which vary from really important issues. I'm not sure if you're aware of how the process works out here, but in order to get a piece of land, a little over an acre of land, for an Navajo person to get that kind of land, they have to go begin this application process, because they call it the home site lease process. Mm-hmm. And that process can take anywhere from a year to 10 years to complete. And for that paperwork to go through, they have to work with the chapter. It goes from the chapter president. It also goes to the grazing official, who is also an elected official. And those folks were also disqualified as well.
Right.
So these are really big implications. I did ask Melvin Harrison what that means if, let's say, all the candidates from a particular chapter were all disqualified.
Right.
How long will it take for those people to be replaced? He said that they're going to hold a special election in February. So it sounds like folks will not have any representation for about a month. That said, I am going to be visiting, covering one of the candidates who they're going to hold a rally today at 6:30 p.m. So I'll be over there this evening.
So this is turning into quite an issue on the reservation. Lots of people are aware that this has happened. This might change for some of those candidates. How are they able to sort of file a grievance, you know, say something like, I didn't have time and I'll do it now kind of thing?
Yes. Well, so they received their letters about a week ago. They had to file their grievance reports by Monday. And again, that's where some of the confusion came in. They thought that, you know, was it 10 days or 10 working days? So, but that said, they, you know, the deadline was on Monday at 5 p.m. And what was interesting about that was that they filed with the Navajo Nation Office of Hearings and Appeals, or OHA. Those folks were at a work session in Albuquerque on the deadline day, Monday. So the hearing officer said that he has 10 days from, I guess, from 5 p.m. Monday to look through all the documents, all the grievances that were filed, and he didn't say how many.
Mm-hmm.
And then he'll deny those that he feels need to be denied, and of course the ones he'll push forward for hearings.
For hearings. So there are some steps still to be had. Let me ask you about the original motivation from the Navajo Council to change these rules, right? To make them much more strict, to encourage the candidates to actually submit their campaign finance report. It was about leveling the playing field?
Basically, according to Mr. Harrison, the reason for this is because in the past they've tried to get candidates to file their expense reports. They also included in that, too, that they have a stipulation that each candidate not spend more than a little over $8,700 during their campaigning. So I guess you could say that will level the playing field so that one candidate does not spend a lot of money and then kind of get more playtime on the radio and whatnot.
Yeah. Okay, so let me just ask you lastly then, Donovan, since this is so in flux, what are you watching for next? Like, do you think it's possible that these nearly 200 candidates who have been disqualified at this point could be significantly reduced, or are you seeing a big hole on the ballot coming up here in November?
I'm anticipating that there's going to be a number of candidates who will be disqualified. I'm not going to say most of them. I will say quite a few of them will be disqualified. I don't think whole chapters will lose all of their candidates. Certainly, I think quite a few of them will be. I'm just thinking about the incumbents who say they've had so many important projects going on that has taken them years to just get to this point, you know, to be able to have a smooth working process now that they're disqualified, and that, you know, if their grievance is not, if it's denied, then they will be ineligible to run for 5 years. And they fear that all the hard work that they put into the programs that they began are going to go away, because if someone else comes in, they don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah. All right. We'll leave it there for now. Lots to come, it sounds like. Donovan Quintero, reporter for the Navajo Times, covering this story. Thank you so much for coming on, Donovan. Appreciate your reporting here.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's the show on KJZZ. I'm joined now in the studio by the show's Sam Dingman. Hey, Sam.
Good morning. Mark, you know, we've heard a lot this week about RFK Jr.'s decision to suspend his presidential campaign and endorse Donald Trump. And a lot of that coverage has focused on analyzing the potential impact of RFK's decision on swing state polls. Now, that's obviously a very important part of the story. But I've been wondering, how do RFK's actual supporters feel about this? What are they talking about this week?
Those seem like pretty good questions. And I understand that earlier this week you went to one of the Valley's little-known political enclaves conveniently located in a nearby shopping center to get some answers.
It's a Wednesday afternoon, and a small group of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. supporters have gathered around a table at Panera Bread. It's been about a week since Kennedy suspended his presidential campaign and endorsed Donald Trump.
And we talked about not about the things that separate us, because we don't agree on everything, but on the values and the issues that bind us together. And one of the issues that he talked about was having safe food and ending the chronic disease epidemic.
This is an open dialogue place, so feel free to talk. And not everyone feels comfortable, which is very fair, okay? And
that's Paula, a Kennedy campaign volunteer. She's the one who organized this get-together. Paula's in her 60s. She has short brown hair and a perpetual smile. She turns to Madison, a young woman holding a toddler, and asks what got her interested in Kennedy.
Probably when he started. He was talking about just, like, cleaning up our food and stuff in the country. That's, like, a really big thing for me.
Next to Madison sits Zach. Zach's 36. He has a thick black beard and wears a blue bandana. As he speaks, he looks around the table, making eye contact with everyone.
I came to Bobby via my important issues, which are really our food. You know, I've had health issues due to food in the past, and I've had a decade of repairing that. And like, if you go to the grocery store, it's all highly processed, chemical ridden food that's destroying our health. It's destroying our guts, affects mental health. You know, you fix our food supply, you fix a lot of issues.
Paula nods as Zach tells his story. Health issues are what first brought her to Kennedy too. When Paula's daughter was 16, she started having fainting spells, and her hair started falling out. They couldn't figure out what was going on.
We didn't know for a whole year. We were in the ER every month, and they found out that she had rheumatoid arthritis at 16.
Doctors prescribed an aggressive campaign of drugs, and Paula's daughter eventually recovered. But the whole thing left Paula wondering how she got so sick in the first place.
When you look at the rise of chronic illness in our children, it doesn't make sense. And so mothers like me, who care about our children, you know, we don't know what to do.
Paula wants the National Institutes of Health to do research on cases like her daughter's. But she doubts it'll happen. Paula doesn't have much faith in the NIH these days.
Because they're bought out by, you know, corporate interests.
Paula feels the same way about the DNC. Once upon a time, she says, she was a regular donor to Democratic candidates. In fact, she was a self-described Bernie bro. In 2016, when she was living in California, Paula voted for Kamala Harris, who was elected to the Senate that year. But 2016 was also the year that Paula started to feel disillusioned by the Democratic Party.
They left me. They made Bernie take the knee when he was winning every, primary, when Biden got one state, because it's all planned.
Zach agrees. He thinks Harris's nomination for the Democratic ticket is part of a grand scheme.
Obviously, the decline of Biden's mental cognition was apparent for a lot longer, and they gaslit America until they got to the point where it looked like Trump was going to beat Biden. Then they roll out Biden for an early debate, unprecedented, because their plan was to replace him. They replaced him, a candidate that nobody voted for. It's very anti-democratic. I don't know how else to say it. It's very black and white to me.
As the group talks about the various things that made them want to get involved in RFK Jr.'s campaign, I can't help noticing that nobody brings up his political lineage. It is mentioned briefly, but only in passing. A former social worker named Jennifer makes oblique reference to the fact that most of Kennedy's relatives have denounced his candidacy. But for Jennifer, that gives Kennedy a kind of emotional credibility.
The way he talks about when people ask him about his family not agreeing with him and how he's okay with that, he's like, everybody disagrees. I have the same thing in my family. I've always been a person that, I sit back and I watch and I don't feel like I fit in a lot of places. And when I started listening to him, I felt like I fit in. He feels like home.
He feels like home. Madison, bouncing her baby on her lap, agrees.
People need somebody who cares, and I don't know, you can feel that when he talks.
Actually, everyone in the group expresses a version of this idea, that part of Kennedy's appeal is that he understands how they feel, like they've had to deal with really scary problems in their lives. They've been lied to by the government, debilitated by mysterious health problems, and it feels like there's no one they can talk to about it.
I feel like a lot of people in my age group, I can't even talk about politics. It's just completely off the table because I have, most of my friends are pretty left-leaning. So it's just hard to have a conversation because there's just kind of that wall where they don't really want to talk and they're just stuck in their ways. So, yeah.
These are big, amorphous concerns. They're hard to define and, in some cases, hard to prove.
I had somebody come at me, you know, on Facebook about how RFK Jr. says that SSRIs lead to mass shootings. And it's like, well, no, he didn't say that. He said that, hey, in America, we have the most mass shootings. We also have the most number of people on SSRIs. They say the side effects are psychosis, anxiety, suicidal ideations, right? Those are listed side effects of these drugs. Let's do a study and see if there is something there.
For the folks around this table, these things feel true.
This country's in crisis, and I have lived experience for all of it. My son, he's 30 now and doing great, but when he was younger, he was having a mental health break, and I got him into someone. They put him on some SSRIs. A week later, he attempted suicide. You know, my husband, I was a widow at 40. My husband was coming home, and a drunk driver killed him, and I had two young kids. So they had a lot of trauma and reasons to be sad, but he was paranoid, and, you know, mass shootings are people who are paranoid, delusional thinking and stuff. So, you know, it's scary, but I'm not the only American mom out there dealing. I have two kids. I'm a widow. And I can't get resources for my kids.
Mass shootings and suicide are undeniably horrific, almost impossible to make sense of. But in Kennedy, this group of supporters sees someone willing to ask big questions that could finally lead to some big answers.
A lot of America lives in a state of fear. And when I watch Bobby, I don't see a state of fear. I see somebody that's living in a state of love. And he's helped me tap into that feeling of love and being more loving towards people that disagree with me.
When he said, "Let's make America healthy again," I cried.
Paula's talking about a line from the speech Kennedy gave when he endorsed Donald Trump.
"And don't you want a president that's going to make America healthy again?"
The endorsement looms over the conversation at Panera Bread. Everyone seems to be processing it in their own way. Paula is thrilled that Trump offered Kennedy a role on his transition team.
If he's on the transition team and he's helping Trump get the right people in, we'll all come together one by one on topics is what I'm hoping. So I'm excited.
Jennifer is not excited.
I have a hard time, like, voting for Trump. And I don't know how to explain it, but he just kind of turns me off.
Zach is somewhere in between.
We're being heard by more people now due to doing the unity party with Trump. And the other side won't even talk. What side am I supposed to go to? The side that's not even coming to the table and talking and listening to ideas, or the side that is? I don't know. It doesn't seem to me like I have a choice.
Zach had a lot of issues with the first Trump administration, but he thinks Kennedy could be a positive influence on Trump. And he's taking Trump at his word that Kennedy would have a big role to play in a potential second term.
I could be wrong, right? Could be duped. Trump could be pulling one over on us. But I'm hoping that they can work together.
And if Trump does keep his word, Kennedy just might be the answer to everything.
Because I want him the head of the NIH, the FDA, the CDC, the CIA, the FBI. I want him everywhere.
The meeting adjourned after about 2 hours. No one ordered any food. For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Sam Dingman.
Good morning. It's The Show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Thousands of Japanese Americans were held in internment camps in Arizona during World War II. Michi Nishiura Weglin was one of them, along with her family. Her story of being forced to live in the camp and then becoming a fashion designer is told in the biography made for middle grade readers called Michi Challenges History, From Farm Girl to Costume Designer to Relentless Seeker of the Truth. As part of our occasional series called Lit Squad, in which we talk to the authors of books for middle grade and young adult readers, I spoke earlier with Ken Mochizuki, the author of Michi Challenges History, and I asked how he first came upon Michi's story.
Well, I always had admiration for those throughout world history, actually, those who were living the comfortable, good life, like they were royalty or something, and then they walked away from all that for some kind of higher calling or purpose that didn't promise anything, total shots in the dark. So Michi was one of those. She was an acclaimed television and stage wardrobe and costume designer. And then she heard U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark say on the news show, Meet the Press, that there never have been, we do not now have, and there never will be concentration camps in this country. Well, Michi spent 2 years of her life in a concentration camp in Arizona called Gila River. And then when she heard that, she just went ballistic. And she said, he's not going to get away with that. And so that's essentially how I found her story. And I thought, well, okay. And it was such an amazing life that the more I researched her life, I just had to do her story.
What surprised you in doing all the research that you did about her life?
I guess it was the amazing ironies in her life. She grew up on a farm in, it's called Brentwood, California. It's in central California. It's midway between Oakland and Stockton. It was a farm town at that time. And then there was lots of animals at the farm. And then there was a lot of chickens. And then she saw that some of the chickens were born without feathers. And so she felt sorry for them. So she designed and made these little furry sweaters for these chickens to wear. And what does she become later on in life? A wardrobe and costume designer.
Yeah. I guess it's one thing to design for chickens. It's another thing for, like, Hollywood A-listers.
Yeah. Yeah, what she did do in the 50s and 60s for some of the big stars of the time.
So your book is as we've said, nonfiction.
Yes.
But it's not for an adult audience, right? Like, this is aimed at, you know, at a preteen to early teen audience, right?
Right. It was targeted for a middle grade. But as with all my books, including my picture books, I write them for adults at the same time also.
So how do you try to tell this story for that age? Because I would imagine, like, there are some things about her life that maybe aren't appropriate for this age, but you still don't want to gloss over it and, you know, and make it seem all, you know, a lot better than it actually was.
Right. Well, actually, I just wrote the way I wanted to. And then I asked my editor at Norton Young Readers, is it appropriate for that age? And he said, yes, it is. So, there are some things you can't have in there. Like, I don't know if this is why the editor deleted it, but when Michi was growing up there in Brentwood, California, and she was always fascinated by costumes, Ziegfeld Follies movies, and so forth. And so she begged her mother to take her to a big town, which I assume was Stockton. And they looked at the posters on the street of the theaters, and then the one that was the most dazzling, her and her sister said to her mom, okay, let's go see this show. So they went in there, and they actually ended up in a burlesque show. and my editor cut that out. I don't know if that's why, but anyway, it was cut out.
Why to you is it so important for, you know, kids of this age group to really understand this part of history? Because it's a part of history that it seems to me, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that until fairly recently, you know, a lot of schools didn't spend a lot of time on, and, you know, a lot of people just didn't really know a whole lot about it.
Yeah, well, that's why. Plus, my family went through this experience, the camp experience during World War II. My parents were there, and my grandparents were there, and my aunts were there. And I had an uncle who was already in the U.S. Army before the war started, so he didn't have to end up in a camp. But, it's something that's glossed over. And you talk to other people, they'll talk about, there was just one paragraph in the history books about the subject. So, it's something that should be known, and it's something that we can't just sweep under the rug. This happened in this country.
Do you find that telling a story like this, of a personal story, as opposed to just teaching sort of the facts and figures and showing some photos, does that help, especially for, you know, for this particular demographic to really understand what happened and maybe what it was like for the people who had to go through it?
I think so. I think you always get your point across better by telling a story rather than just reciting some facts and figures. And especially this story, as I was talking about, it's such an amazing story that, you tell it through a medium of a person's experience.
Ken Mochizuki is author of the biography Michi Challenges History, From Farm Girl to Costume Designer to Relentless Seeker of the Truth. And that'll do it for this Friday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. If you're looking for new music to listen to, boy, have we got you covered. Maybe you've got a road trip for this Labor Day weekend. Our August playlist with every song we've played on the show this month is up on Spotify. Just search KJZZ's The Show on the app. And if Spotify isn't enough appdom for you, make sure to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. Have a terrific rest of your day. Have a great and safe holiday weekend. Hope to have you right back here on Monday. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.